elements that we should cover, but it sounds as if the postdoc was just seemed a natural piece of life, and then something happened. Yeah. But are there anything else out of Caltech?
Well, there's just a few questions that I had. One was, I wondered if there was any sort of weekly chemistry seminar that the graduate students went to at Caltech. Was there any common experience for?
There were seminars. There wasn't a regular, as I recall, there wasn't a regular departmental seminar that everybody had to be at on a given day. And I'm sure that some professors ran their own seminar for their students because they were all involved in similar work. I'm sure Pauling ran one for his crystallographic group, that sort of thing. But then I wouldn't go to those. I was pretty focused on, you know, what I wanted to do and what I wanted to get done. And so I didn't really branch out a lot. But I stayed on the job, and there was plenty to do.
Did you have regular meetings as a group with Yost?
No.
Yeah.
All my meetings with Yost were, I think, almost entirely just he and I, and I probably didn't have more than maybe half a dozen meetings with him in the whole 3 years.
Wow.
Probably two meetings a year. He would walk into the lab once in a while and say, you know, how are things going? What's happening here? But I didn't see a lot of him.
And you mentioned that Waugh had the laboratory space next to yours. Did you?
Yes.
Did you? What was your interaction with him?
Well, I think that really does need to be elaborated a little bit, because this is why I got interested in NMR. Is that he was working with a very primitive magnet, a terrible magnet, really, a very bad homogeneity. It was only because it was a monster that it had any homogeneity. It was a great, huge magnet powered by submarine batteries, a whole block of submarine batteries that were kept charged. And so when it was running, it was draining these batteries, and of course the voltage was slowly changing, so the field steadily drifted. At least it drifted more or less slowly, so you could offset it a little bit, offset the drift. But he had to do NMR on the fly, basically, because of the instability of his equipment. And this really limited him to looking at NMR in solids, where the lines are very broad, so that a small drift doesn't distort the data appreciably.
Mm-hmm.
And so his experiments were in areas where I wasn't particularly interested in the science, as he was studying the locations of hydrogen atoms in crystals of various types and things like that. And where it looked to me like things that you could work with organic molecules would be much more useful in the long run, because there's so much more variety there and so much greater need for analysis, that if you really wanted to make an instrument that was useful, and I was always thinking, you know, an instrument ultimately has got to be useful. The one I'm making is not, but I'm getting practice, but I don't plan to try to convert this thing into anything else. So I got familiar with the basics of NMR, just talking to John and looking at his at what he was doing. And then one day I went to an electronics show in Los Angeles, because we needed new Klystron tubes for the microwave spectrometer. And Varian had an exhibit down there. It was actually put on by their Los Angeles representative. And so Varian's Klystrons were featured. And they were wonderful Klystrons. They had great specifications, but they were a couple $1,000 a piece, and we didn't have that kind of a budget. So my trip was wasted going down to look at the Klystrons, but while I was there, I saw a little stack of papers on a table, and it was a description of a 12-inch diameter electromagnet for NMR, a high-resolution electromagnet that had been developed at Stanford University and was being offered for sale by Varian. And with it, a reprint from the Physical Review in which they Martin Packard, let's see, and an Indian chemist named Darmati had observed three peaks from ethyl alcohol by using a small sample in this big magnet and stabilizing it so that they could actually scan slowly enough to see the separated three peaks. When I saw those three peaks of ethyl alcohol from a condensed phase liquid, I thought, this is the kind of a thing that could actually be an analytical instrument. It just needs to be improved. And I'm excited because here's a company who's already... This has just been printed, been discovered a month ago or 2 months ago, and they are offering it for sale. They're offering the magnet for sale already. So I thought, this is the kind of company I want to be associated with. And I had already decided I don't want an academic job. I want to be in a company that's trying to do something, make something useful, make money, but mainly to make something products which are really useful. And I never ever looked seriously at an academic job. Part of the reason for that was that I saw some of the things that go on in academia that I didn't think were admirable or fun. How hard people had to work to raise money, how many proposals they had to write to get any support, how competitive they were, how they became sometimes so overwhelmed by their own importance that it became a kind of a contest between the leaders in a field, so that you go to seminars and you'd find that the seminar consisted of a few people in the front row who talked to each other for several hours and other people who listened to it, but there was no real interchange. And I thought, this environment doesn't strike me as the kind of thing that I feel comfortable in. I think I'll be a lot happier with a set of goals, resources to get there. You don't have to go ask for money. You have a budget, and all you have to do is justify your projects. So I was looking for an industrial job, and in fact, if I hadn't gone to Varian, I would have gone to GE, because I had a good time there in the summer that I worked there.
Was this the seeing the Klystrom? This was before or after you'd taken your final orals?
This was, I think this was, let's see, when did I do that? I've got the date.
Don't worry.
I've got the date on the letter right here. Because I actually have a copy of that letter. Yeah, somebody kindly found that letter for me and saved it. Or made it isn't the original, it's a copy of it. But this must be it lurking in here. Yes, there it is. And it's dated July 13, 1951. So it is after my final orals. I was just finishing up some of the work, I guess, because then I didn't get my degree until 52. By that time, I was at Varian. So, yeah, it was about the time I was finishing up my work.
So you saw this in the Los Angeles show, and then...
And I thought, I want to write to Varian and suggest that they need somebody like me to do applications, to develop applications for this instrument, because how are you going to sell a thing this expensive if you can't show people what they can do with it that's relevant to their work? So you got to be able to take their problems and solve them. And that's what I proposed in this letter. And
may we would love to get a copy of this.
Oh, sure.
Put it in with the oral history, I think.
Oh, yeah. This is my only copy, but you could have the secretary copy it.
You didn't write a similar letter to anyone else?
No. Because I hadn't really gone job searching yet, but I thought, I'll find out whether Marion is at all interested in this. And they said, why don't you come see us?
So that led... So that led directly to the job offer and employment, is that?
Yes. Yeah. I came up and just talked with them, told them that I was currently doing a postdoctoral fellowship, but that I could take off if necessary, and they made me an offer, and so I told my professor that I'm sorry I can't finish the fellowship. Is that okay with you? And he said yes.
So, talk about who you came to see. What the result of this letter? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go out and see if I can get it copied. And I'll be back later. But keep
okay.
Right on.
Well, yes. When I came up here, I had written to Merle Stearns, who was he was a tube engineer originally, but he had become the general manager of the company. And so he wasn't the person to talk to, but he had passed it on to a man named Ralph Kane, K-A-N-E, who was at that time running the instrument division at Varian. They called it the Special Products Division at that time. It wasn't instrument yet, because they didn't have an instrument. But they were aiming for an instrument. And so I talked to Ralph Kane and explained why I wanted to work for Varian, what I wanted to do at Varian, and why I thought it was important. And I got an offer back in the mail. And I was the 512th employee of Varian.
How large was the special products division?
Probably about 50 people.
About 50 people.
At that point in time.
And most of
that was
the 450 other people were mainly...
They were making vacuum tubes.
Making the tubes.
Yeah, and of course some corporate services.
Sure.
And that sort of thing. But there are probably 50 people who were involved in the science. There was a research department, engineering group.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were the technicians and machinists that supported them. And then there was a production facility of people who put what equipment they were selling together, and then some people in sales. And that was about it. And that it probably added up to about 50 people, I would say, when I came there.
And were they had developed the magnet as a component for sale. Did they have other...
They had, yeah, the first thing they made when they started working was a flux meter. It used NMR to measure the strength of a magnetic field.
Mm.
So all it consisted of was a radio frequency unit connected by a cable to a probe, which was a little tube about this long with some tuned circuits in it and a coil of wire with a sample of water in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you stuck that in whatever magnetic field you wanted to measure, and twiddle the knobs until you got to the resonant frequency, and then you could bring it to exact measurement of the frequency, and by comparing then using the relationship between the precession frequency of hydrogen atoms and the frequency, the precession frequency and the field strength,
mm-hmm.
That you could calculate from the measured frequency in this instrument,
right,
the field strength was. And that could all be done internally and calibrated and come read out on a knob. So you had a device called a flux meter then, which you could put in any magnet. And of course, if it was a really inhomogeneous magnet, you would get such a blur of a thing you couldn't read it. But if it was a decent homogeneous region of field, you could.
Mm-hmm.
And this was used for people who were building cyclotrons to
right.
find out what the field strength was. You could have this at the end of a 50-foot cable. And so it was useful. And they were selling them. And they had in mind to build the spectrometer to go with the high-resolution magnet. That was part of the
right.
business plan. And so when I came along and said I'd like to find applications for this instrument, and I think I mentioned in the letter, I'm sure you will develop the more things to go with the magnet.
Mm-hmm.
That was their plan, and so that all made a great deal of sense. The thing that many people don't know, but it is described in some books that had come out about the life of Russell and Sigurd Varian, is that Varian Associates was actually started in order to exploit the potential of NMR. It was purely an economic necessity that made them go back into the tube business and seek contracts from the government.
Right.
And it was the fact that Sputnik suddenly appeared on the scene that made those contracts, money for those contracts available. So it was a confluence of developments that all happened to come together. So anyway, the company went into business in 1948, but in 1947, 1 year after the discovery of NMR
mm-hmm.
by Felix Bloch
right.
and Hansen, who patented it, they didn't actually patent it themselves. At the end of 1 year, the length of time that you have to patent an idea before it becomes public domain,
mm-hmm.
after it's been published, Russell Varian showed up in Felix Bloch's office and said, here is a copy of a patent for NMR, and you sign here.
Really?
And get Hansen to sign here. And he said, here is an exclusive license for Varian Associates. Sign that here. You haven't got much time. And Bloch signed that. And so then Varian had an exclusive license for the technique of NMR. And that was all written in proper terms so that it defined what NMR was. And that actually prevented any competition from marketing anything that was based on the principle of nuclear magnetic resonance for 17 years. And it was only after 17 years that Varian actually had competition,
right.
Other people coming in. And, of course, then they started to draw royalties anyway because there were improvement patents,
mm-hmm.
so you could give them the whole package. I think probably even before 17 years passed, people were coming asking for licenses, and you could see they were going to go ahead and develop things anyway, so you might as well get something during the last few years of the patent.
Right.
So Felix Bloch made a great deal of money out of this because... The business grew to be millions of dollars, and so some certain percentage, I think it might have been something like 5% or something, went to Felix Bloch. Ultimately, Felix Bloch became very difficult to deal with.
Hmm.
I think it was more money than he'd ever seen before in his life, and so he could be very tough to negotiate with. It began to be difficult to pay the 5% on everything. It was limiting what Varian could do in the way of making the expected kind of profits and things. So they would go and negotiate with him, and he was difficult. But I think it must have been really even more of a problem for Felix, given this situation, that he was only getting half of the royalties because the patent was signed by Russell Varian and Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
And Hansen died, and his half of the patent was part of his estate and went to his brother, who was a graphic artist who came up with the Smokey the Bear campaign in California. And so this graphic artist, who knew absolutely nothing about science or NMR, was getting a check equal to the one that Felix Bloch was getting. And I think that must have made Felix feel like there'd been some miscarriage of justice or something there. But it was kind of an interesting situation that developed out of that. But Felix received a lot of money, and I'm sure that it made it all worthwhile for him to have done the work that he did in discovering NMR.
And he was
a consultant for Varian, right. And the relations were always amicable. But when it came time to discuss the royalties, why, they always got quite tense.
Mm-hmm.
And
but that didn't seem to preclude, from my reading, it seemed like there was a good, a regular exchange of personnel.
There was a very good exchange of ideas. We had there were seminars at Stanford, and we always went to them as long as he ran them, which was for several years. All the students that worked under Felix Bloch came to Varian. There wasn't any other place to go and get a job in NMR. And so they were all really more interested in the instruments than in the applications, because there weren't any applications yet. And Felix, being a physicist, wasn't interested in chemical applications.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was kind of interesting, because when I went to these seminars, I kept my mouth shut, because I knew that this guy is a the top of the line physicist. And he was the kind of man who didn't take any ignorance lightly. You know, he would really read you out if you were wrong. He would make it clear that you were really off base. So I was very cautious about what I said about the NMR. But whenever I talked about the applications we were doing, he and his group listened carefully. And of course, I was on pretty solid ground on the interpretation of the spectra and that sort of thing. And then, whenever that happened, whenever Felix came over to Varian and was working with us, he was always very respectful and very careful not to talk about too much about chemistry, because he didn't want to get caught up in being wrong either. And I found that this is a kind of a universal thing, that people, when they get out of their field, suddenly become very careful about what they say, right, and how they act. And that was true for Felix Bloch, and I've since then discovered it's true for Edward Teller. I've gotten to know Edward Teller pretty well by visiting him often when my wife is working with him. And when we talk about physics, I'm very cautious. When we talk about chemistry, he's very cautious.
So did they, when they made you the offer to come join Varian in the special products division, did they have a job description? Did Ralph Kane have a job description for you in mind, or was it essentially, we liked what you describe in your letter?
That was basically it, yes.
Come and start some activity.
I essentially wrote my own job description,
right,
which was to come and set up a laboratory in which to do applications work. And it turned out that when I got there, setting up a laboratory meant build the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing I had experience building instruments.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to do it anyway, because they had a customer. In those days, they had a guy running the division who was pretty much an entrepreneur, and he didn't hesitate to sell something that they didn't have and make a promise on the delivery. And so they had this sold this instrument to a Texas oil company. When I arrived,
Humble
Oil Company, and the first thing I had to do was to build the radio frequency unit working at 30 megahertz,
mm-hmm.
and that had been chosen very cleverly because 30 megahertz works at about 7,000 Gauss, and that's about how much field you could get out of the magnet with a reasonable amount of current that wouldn't burn it up.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 megahertz amplifiers were available because that was the intermediate frequency used in radar, and so there were racks of amplifiers that were surplus equipment.
Okay.
The technology of 30 megahertz amplifiers was well established, so that became the frequency of the first spectrometer. And but we had to design it in such a way that it was all on one chassis, so that it would fit into a cabinet,
mm-hmm.
couldn't be distributed all over the place like in a research lab. And so my job was to build the transmitter and the receiver. And for some reason, the engineer who designed it was a good electronics engineer. He designed a fine transmitter and a fine receiver, but he located them on the same single chassis. And that produced a big shielding problem because the
mm-hmm.
receiver is sitting there right next to the transmitter. It would have been a lot easier to shield it if they'd been on separate chassis in separate boxes in a rack mount.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been just as logical to do it. Anyway, I got the drawings. I converted them into what this guy had designed. I didn't see that I should have separated them into two boxes. So we built it all on one chassis, and we had a lot of trouble filtering out the frequencies, the direct pickup.
Yeah.
I finally got it so it worked, and that was the RF unit that was sold for about the first 5 years.
Hmm.
And there were things about that unit that, you know, were real problems simply because of this locating the transmitter and receiver on the same chassis. But I got it built, and as soon as it was built, we started testing it. We had the magnet all ready to go,
mm-hmm.
and started testing it, and it did not take us very long to meet the specifications of the system, which were very, very loose. See the three separate peaks of ethyl alcohol.
Oh, really? That was the spec.
That's all we really had to do, was to put a sample of ethyl alcohol into the magnet, find a good spot, and show three separate peaks.
Hmm.
They would take the research from there. So that was one of the better acceptance specifications that I ever had to deal with, because it was simple,
mm-hmm.
just one thing you had to do.
And that was the first order?
That was and they had already taken that order, and it was about due to be delivered, and I got it done in time. And then I, in fact, went to Texas to install it, because, I mean, who knew more about it, you know, how to operate it? None of our engineers or assemblers knew anything about the instrument. So I had to test it, then I had to go install it, and we did get somebody then who became a service engineer and learned about the instrument so that I wouldn't have to go every time
mm-hmm.
something went wrong. And we started building the second one, and that was put into my application laboratory. So about, maybe 4 or 5 months after I arrived at Varian, I finally had a system of my own that I could then do either what you would have to call research of trying to understand the spectra that came out of
mm-hmm.
NMR instruments and relate them to problems of chemical interest, or if somebody was interested, had heard about NMR and wanted to know if you could do anything with it in their field, I would talk to them about what sort of problems they had, and we would look at samples that looked like we could get some information that would be useful in solving their problems.
Did you do that sort of work for free as a way to establish the technique?
Yeah,
right.
Because we were benefiting as much as they were.
Right.
We were building a body of knowledge, and we were we would, in fact, we started in a fairly soon, we started a technical information bulletin, and shortly after that, and we would put these examples of spectra into this technical information bulletin and a basic explanation of what NMR is, send it out to a mailing list of people who had shown interest at trade shows and things. And then maybe after about a year, I think we started a monthly series of advertisements. And it turned out when we wanted to get the space I think it was on the journal, in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, mm-hmm. that every chemist reads. I think there isn't a lot of advertising space in that journal. And so the only place that was left was the back cover. And we looked at the back cover and we thought, you know, there's a 50% chance every time the thing is laid down that the back cover will be facing up and people will see our ad. They don't have to find it in the magazine. This mm-hmm. is ideal. Everybody else had wanted to get inside, and we got the back cover, and we kept it for 5 years. And we made 60 ads once a month. There was This Is NMR at Work was the name of the ad series. And there was an example with interpretation of the spectrum. And after a while, we weren't just interpreting spectra. We were actually showing that this interpreted spectrum solved a problem, like a structure. Mm-hmm. Structure.
At so if you were sort of the second customer, in a way, yeah. the applications lab over at Humble, who was the end user there? Was it
there was a guy in the research department mm-hmm. whose name was Raleigh Williams, and he was doing research into analytical techniques and trying to apply analytical techniques to the problems of the oil industry.
Right.
And they thought, and correctly so, they ought to be able to analyze petroleum mixtures to get a profile of, the different types of petroleum feedstocks and things, mm-hmm. and that information ought to be usable. And ultimately, it did become quite usable, and I think almost every oil company now relies very heavily on NMR, along with their more traditional mass spectrometric methods,
mm-hmm.
and of course, chromatography is very important in that field also.
Right.
But NMR gets a different kind of information when you put information from different sources together, then you really narrow things down very quickly, and it's been a very important thing in the petroleum business, and in particularly it's made huge contributions to the structure of polymers,
mm-hmm.
and the petroleum business is almost as much polymers as it is fuel.